Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning there, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well.
Yeah.
And I was reading in the news, in some of the obscure news that we tend to read, about a high school sport that I could respect. Not that I don't respect high school sports, but, you know, I wasn't exact. You were a football player. You were a wrestler.
You were not the big jock of your high school, were you?
Well, does the debating team count?
It does not.
No, huh? You couldn't letter on the debating team, could you?
You could not.
Yeah, all right. Well, in California, it seems that they have a different high school sport. California schools were geared up for the state finals in vine pruning.
Great.
That's right, actual high school vine pruning teams. On February 3rd, 38 contestants faced off in the Ruby Cabernet and Flame Seedless Spur Pruning Thompson Cane Pruning events. Last year's title holder was Paso Robles High School. They came in fourth this year. They were beat out by Kingsburg High, which claimed the number one spot. And what's funny is, we should tell people what pruning is, right? It's where you go through the vines.
I mean, you know what pruning is for your own trees and for your own...
winter time, you know, and you prune things back?
Cut things back.
You know what? Call me cynical, but if I owned a vineyard and I needed it pruned...
I'd sponsor the pruning contest.
I was like, you can prune my vineyard and I won't even charge you. You can do this back-breaking work for free.
So I got to tell you, yeah, I played football. Yeah, I wrestled. Yeah, I was on the track team. But at the same time, my dirty little secret...
Yeah.
I was also on the bowling team.
Oh, yeah. Actually.
But you know what?
What?
Seems like that's not so bad now compared to the pruning team.
Did you letter in bowling?
I did, as a matter of fact.
Oh, yeah, baby. All right, now, this sport is taken in California very seriously among high schools in the wine-growing areas, and they issue fully detailed breakdowns of stats, reports in the local press, just with all the other high school sports that's covered, financial support from local businesses, like with the picture of the team at the pizzeria wall. And with all those statistics, I've come up with my own idea that you and I can work together on.
All right, I'm listening.
Ready for this?
I don't think I am, actually. Go ahead.
A fantasy pruning league.
I think you're an idiot.
We could have the different players.
Yeah, I understand what you mean.
All right, more news. Here was something disappointing. Mark, do you know what a Melquire is?
It's a really, really, really big bottle, and that's all I know.
Do you know how many regular bottles of wine worth of wine is in a Melquire?
Somewhere between 5 and 1 million.
Yeah, you're in the range. A Melquire, like big bottles of wine have names, like a double bottle is a Magnum, and then there's a Jeroboam and a Nebuchadnezzar. These are bigger and bigger bottles of wine. Well, a Melquire is a huge bottle of wine that holds the equivalent. The same amount of liquid as 24 bottles of regular wine.
That's two cases of wine in one bottle.
It's huge.
Okay.
These things are, sometimes you'll go to a charity event or something, you'll have a big bottle there for a photo op that is, you know, was basically made for the event,
uh-huh.
Right? But when you have a bottle of wine that's made that way and the young wine is put in one of these large bottles with a large cork, it's very, very expensive. The bottles are much more expensive. And frankly, in fine wine, when you go out to a restaurant...
Mm-hmm.
If you get a magnum of wine, which is a double bottle of wine, will often be more than double the price of
Correct.
A single bottle of wine because the bottle is more expensive, and also wine ages much better in larger size bottles.
For a lot of reasons.
For a lot of reasons. And they're also rare. So when you're talking about collectible wines, when you mm-hmm. see them in large bottles, magnums and double magnums and Methuselahs and Nebuchadnezzars, they get very expensive. Well... some of the most rare wines in California was Colgan is the name of a producer out there, and they mm-hmm. make a wine from the Herb Lamb Vineyard, a guy named Herb Lamb, and it's a very expensive, auctionable bottle of wine.
For a while, a woman by the name of Helen Turley was making Colgan wines.
Well, what Ann Colgan, who's the winemaker, did with her husband, Fred Schrader, they made two Melquires each in the years 92 through 96, right? Two each. So that's two of these huge bottles in each year.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the divorce between Fred Schrader and Ann Colgan, he got one set, she got the other. Seems fair. She still has hers at the cellar. He sold his to a casino, which sold it to somebody else, which sold it to somebody else. Came up for auction last week. You want to know what they were going for, what the projected price of the auction was?
A few hundred bucks.
If this bottle of wine from California, a Melquire, which is 24 bottles, and it was five, 92, 93, 94, 95, 96. The estimate of what they were hoping to get for this lot of five Melquires, which is just basically 10 cases of wine, right?
Right.
$400,000 to $600,000.
That's a lot of money.
For six bottles of wine?
That's,
I'd say.
Well, it's for...
Right, you couldn't drink it with a straw. It's a big bottle of wine. But
120 bottles of wine.
But that's $500,000 for you know, an American wine. Want to know what happened?
Yeah.
The cork slipped into the neck of the wine. In other words, it went... And the wine's ruined.
Wow.
Ouch!
Which probably means that the it wasn't stored properly, or there's something something leading up to this incident caused the cork to shrink.
600? What a party that would be, man.
That's a party. You know what, though? And, you know, yes, this is 10 cases of wine. But you're talking about $40,000 cases of wine. And my question to you here is, are you paying for the gimmick that it's in a 24... 24 bottle in a Melquire, or are you paying for the wine itself?
I think that you're paying for the rarity, and is a stamp that's worth $100,000. You know, if you lick it, is it that good? No. I mean, is it going to send your letter all around the world a bunch more times? No. It's not. It's not the postage. You know what I mean? It's when things become a collector's item, and we talk about this all the time with people. When people are buying wines, you know, a lot of people talk about the futures and what they're going to go for. And what we always talk to when we in our retail work, and certainly in the restaurants, is, I don't care how many points it got.
Right.
I don't care how collectible it's going to be. I don't care that, you know, this $50 bottle is going to be worth $100 bottles next year. Your veal is coming out in 10 minutes. You know, you're going to drink it. And are you going to like it or not? You know, and that's the most important thing. But still, from a, you know, it's just a nerdy thing to look at this collection that five Melquires of Colgan Herb Lamb cork sucked into the bottle.
That's really
sucked it. Can you imagine watching
really
that?
Bad.
You know, the same thing happened with a Thomas Jefferson bottle many years ago. Chateau Mouton Rothschild was one of the best Bordeaux houses. Used to, for heads of state only, would make special bottlings with their names on it. And there was a Thomas Jefferson bottle of Lafitte. It was Lafitte Rothschild.
From when Jefferson was president.
And at that time, it was like $20,000, which, you know, hell, seems like nothing compared to this. But it was sent into the 21 Club, and they stored it under lights. And the lights heated it up, and so then when they turned the lights off, it contracted, and it sucked the cork back into the bottle.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Well, there's been
grand.
Lots of stories with those
grand,
Jefferson
now
bottles.
$200.
Also, somebody dropped one of those bottles while
luggage.
Presenting it.
And insurance didn't cover it because you're not supposed to carry
and
wine.
And another bottle
in
broke in someone's luggage. That's exactly right.
Oh, my God. All right. Well, when we come back, we're going to be talking with Andrea Strong, who's our favorite food blogger, about what's happening in the food world today. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And we welcome as our guest today, yet again, the queen of the food blogosphere, Andrea Strong.
Andrea, welcome to the show.
The queen. Wow.
Yeah, you got promoted.
Thank you. I'm waiting for my servants to arrive.
I think it's called elevated when you're queen. I don't think you get promoted to queen. That's not what they call it. They have their own language. So, hey, listen, the food blogosphere we've talked about a lot recently, and I see that you are going to be offering a workshop on food blogging.
Yes, just what the world needs, a class on how to start your own food blog.
Well, tell us about this.
Andrea, I have to say, the world really does need this,
yeah.
Okay? And we'll talk about the rest of the food bloggers after you tell us what's going on.
Well, the class is at the Institute for Culinary Education, which is on 23rd Street, and it's basically a workshop that helps aspiring writers figure out what they want to say and if they have enough to say to start a food blog. I mean, I think one of the points that I'm going to be making is that, you really need to have a point of view and an identity and a purpose in writing a food blog. I don't think that we need another blog to tell us what restaurant is opening or, you know, why you like grilled cheese or, you know, sort of a diary of what you ate that week. The point of the class is to sort of help people figure out what they can add to the blogging world that isn't already there and how to articulate that vision, both in terms of writing and on the technical side. I'm bringing my web designer, Harvey Crisworth, who will talk about, you know, the different options in terms of building a website. So we'll get into the technical aspects of it as well. So it's sort of an all-around, like, how to write a blog, why you should write a blog, and once you figure out what you want to say, how to build it or design it or do it yourself with blogging software.
Do you think, though, that in order to have a food blog that's credible, you need to be a person who goes out to dinner enough and has enough culinary experience or goes, whether it's out to dinner at a restaurant or goes and finds whatever branch of food that it is you're talking about or producing? Don't you think that there's an issue? I see a lot of, like, amateur food blogs out there who, like you said, talk about what they had for dinner that night, and it's just...
A great word, diary of what you ate. That's...
Who cares?
I don't want to read somebody's diary.
I think that there are different kinds of blogs. There are some that are really just people who want somewhere to put their thoughts, and they may not get much traffic. And then there are others who actually have... you know, just an inviting voice. I mean, the woman who did the Julie and Julia blog, she wasn't an authority, but she's a great writer and presented herself as someone who was trying to learn and really struck a chord with a lot of her readers. So I think it depends on what kind of blog you want to write. If you want to write a blog as a reviewer and as someone in the industry, then I think you should have some experience because there are a lot of people out there who are, you know, making names for themselves and basically they're mildly ignorant when it comes to culinary history and food and eating out.
Andrew, you're understating that a little bit with some of the bloggers.
First of all, let me tell everybody out there that Andrea not only has the strongbuzz.com where you can go and visit, you can link that through our website, but she also, her works appear in the New York Post every Sunday. She writes for New York Magazine, the New York Times, Time Out New York, Real Simple, Condé Nast Traveler. So, you know, Andrea is an authority on this, and if you want to find out more, you can go to iceculinary.com, or we'll also link you and put the information for the workshop, which is February 28th at the Institute of Culinary Education in New York.
So, Andrea, for the common person going out into the blogosphere, what do they do so they can differentiate the real blogs, the articles, real articles like the ones you write, from the pretenders? Because there's tons of pretenders out there now.
You know, in terms of seeking out a blog that speaks to you, it's great to visit eater.com. They have a list of blogs that they like and just get out there and see what's out there and find out what works for you. I mean, everyone's different. Some people like to cook at home, and there's a lot of blogs about cooking and different recipes. Some people like wine, and there are food blogs, you know, more sort of wine blogs. Some people are more into, you know, comedy, and there's plenty of people who are trying to be very funny about food. The Amateur Gourmet is a blog that I like, and Adam Roberts is the author, and he's very funny and sort of whimsical, and he has an MFA. He's also a former lawyer, and he's a great writer. He just actually got a book deal. So, you know, I think for anyone out there who's interested in reading blogs, the best way to figure out which one you like is just to sort of get out there and read. And if you're thinking about writing a blog, I think you also need to get out there and see what's already there and figure out what you can add that's different, because, you know, we're at this point where it's just like there's no barrier to entry, so everyone and their mother, grandmother, cousin, and niece is blogging about something.
And one of the things that you're seeing is the blogs that are coming up sometimes that are at the front of the line are the guy who happens to be have a lot of computer savvy, mm-hmm. as opposed to the guy who's got a lot of food acumen. Mm-hmm. You know, you're seeing those pop up to the top a lot. These and what truly they are computer geeks, not food geeks.
You know, I think what's interesting though is, and this is an age old argument about, you know, what is the food critic's expertise? And I think in the blogosphere, there people spend as much time out on the internet criticizing each other and pointing out who's the best. And I think. You know, we were recently reviewed by a restaurant critic in a bricks and mortar publication, mm-hmm. who said something like, you know, and the mozzarella came out and it wasn't chilled. I was like, yeah, that's because I made it a minute before I brought it to your table. What are you talking about? You know, and so the idea of having, you know, some credibility and expertise is always an issue with a restaurant reviewer,
yeah.
whether they're in print or on the web.
I do think that is a sad side effect of the blog, is that there are a lot of people out there who think that they know what they're talking about who don't, and they're spreading their lore around the internet with confidence, and affecting businesses. And there was an article in this Sunday Style section, mm-hmm. this past Sunday about food bloggers, and Jason Hennings, the owner of EU, was quoted to say, you know, here's this girl, the restaurant girl, who is a former actress who has very little knowledge about food, coming in on the first day that Akhtar is the new chef of a restaurant, 4 hours before, after he's first walked into.
You know what?
You've just raised
two issues that I want to talk about in just a moment. We'll be back with Andrea Strong with TheStrongBuzz.com. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, and we're talking with Andrea Strong of TheStrongBuzz.com.
You know, Andrea, you were talking just a couple minutes ago about an article written this week in the New York Times by Alan Salkin, mm-hmm. about, you know, how some people feel that the blogs are really helping their restaurant owners, I'm talking about now, mm-hmm. or feel like the blogs are really helping their business and bringing people to them. And at the other side of it, though, is the owner of EU complaining, you know, you brought in, you are on the blogosphere and you're talking about my restaurant 4 hours after my chef is in. This, mm-hmm. you know, which, you know, Francis and I know as owners, he hasn't even ordered the ingredients that are on the menu.
Yeah, it's absolutely ridiculous. I mean, I think as one of the things that I'm also going to be talking about in my blogging class is a sense of responsibility as a journalist for what you're writing. And that responsibility not only extends to your readers, but there's also a responsibility to a restaurant where if a chef literally has started that day, you don't go into the restaurant and review it.
Yeah, I think
it's not fair, and I don't want to be pandering to restaurants, but you know, this is someone's livelihood, and
well, it's also not fair to the reader because that's going to exist forever up on the internet somewhere,
exactly.
And you're going to read it 6 months from now and say, "Oh, well, EU, it was terrible," and when in reality, EU was terrible in its first 2 hours of its birth.
Yeah.
You know,
well, how long do you think is respectful to wait when a new restaurant opens up? How long before you'll write a review?
I've written a review as quickly as 2 to 3 weeks.
But do you then feel obliged to re-review shortly?
No, I generally don't re-review unless there's a new chef.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really have there's not a lot of time to even get to the new restaurants. But I would say within the first month I will write a review. But I think that that's significantly different than 4 hours after someone has taken over a restaurant that has had three other chefs previously, and he's still dealing with the other chef's menu and hasn't even really gotten his own dishes.
When we come back after the news, Andrea, I want to talk about two things. One is your top 10 list for last year, which you published in December, and I also want to talk about your trip to New Orleans. We're talking with Andrea Strong of TheStrongBuzz.com. We'll be talking more with her after the news. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1130.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with The Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Cathal Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Today's guest is Andrea Strong. She writes for the New York Post. She's written for the Bloomberg News, the New York Times. She co-wrote Sparks in the Kitchen with Katie Sparks. And today, we're here talking about the blogosphere. And specifically, I wanted to ask you, Andrea, you wrote, I thought it was something pretty beautiful that you wrote. You wrote in one of your most recent newsletters to me.
Mm-hmm.
I saw you were talking about New Orleans. And
well,
you wrote,
it wasn't just to you, Francis.
Well, yeah.
It was just to you.
I knew you were going
to
get me on that one. Okay. it was about New Orleans. It was about your visit to New Orleans, and I thought that was a very moving piece. And I'll just read from it for a moment. You said, "I saw a wounded city of unstoppable souls fighting to make it back. People are working. People are smiling. People are playing their trumpets and beating their drums. People are fixing po'boys, ladling out gumbo, pouring abitas, and taking reservations. There's a community here just waiting to serve." Tell us about New Orleans.
I went to New Orleans at the end of December, and I hadn't been since after... The last time I'd been was before Hurricane Katrina, and I was both devastated and inspired by my trip. It really, many of the neighborhoods look like a tornado blew through them a week ago. There's a major housing crisis, and the city is really struggling to get back on its feet. And in the French Quarter, you really can't tell that anything happened, but once you get out of the French Quarter and into the other neighborhoods, it's really, there's a lot of devastation still there, and but there's also this incredible sense of joy and hope and life and that really has defined New Orleans for
forever.
Forever. There's great music, there's great food, there are chefs really pouring their hearts and souls into their restaurants, much, much more so than before Katrina, because they're, in this case, really short on staff. So, I mean, if you go to Biona, Susan Spicer is there every night. She's cooking, she just finished rebuilding her house, and... you know, she's there because it's really hard for restaurants to get staff. There's no place to put them. There's a housing shortage.
You know, I think what's interesting about New Orleans that I've read from a few people who've written about it, and we've talked to people down in New Orleans on the show, is that unlike any other city who was dealt that sort of devastation, I think most other cities would work on getting their infrastructure back, work on getting their buildings back, work on getting their bus lines back, work on getting their houses back. And then when all that was done, you might see restaurants start to come back.
Mm-hmm.
New Orleans, you know, it is a city that is based on music and food and culture. And
mm-hmm.
it's my impression from reading that, you know, food was one of those restaurants, and being able to come out and go and have a communal meal with strangers or friends is one of the first things they made sure to be able to restore, to keep the culture alive.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the restaurants opened, similar to what happened in New York after September 11th, a lot of restaurants sheltered people, had people living at Drago's, which was a great oyster bar that we went to. They kept Drago's open, and they put cots and blankets down, and people slept there and used it as their home, and they cooked whatever they could find, and they really were the safe haven and the home for hundreds of people.
Hmm.
Same thing for some restaurants in the French Quarter. I mean, the roads were blocked, food couldn't get in, people were starving and frightened, and restaurants really provided shelter and some form of safety and love for a community of people that were devastated and on the brink of death.
Really amazing. Yeah. You know, Andrew, you spent nearly a perfect week down there. You went down there. You worked for Habitat for Humanity.
Yeah, that was a great experience, and I highly recommend it to your listeners. If you have a week off from work and you have kids, or you just want to go down by yourself, they'll put you up. But it's a great experience to go down there and put your hands on a hammer and build something that will house a family one day. Mm-hmm. And it really does make you feel like you're doing something that really will make a difference to someone.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then I think you made a difference too, because what'd you do? You went into restaurants, you spent money, you mm-hmm. helped. I mean, that's one of...
Pigged out.
But that's part of how New Orleans is trying to bring itself back up. That's exactly what Francis was saying. They're kind of almost starting with the restaurant scene, bringing that back and trying to bring tourism and the other good things that come from that.
If someone were interested to go as a tourist, is it a good idea to go to New Orleans at this point and go out to dinner and spend a week there? Or?
Definitely.
Yeah?
There's great food in New Orleans, and most of the restaurants are reopened now. We went to a great place called Table One, which is on Magazine Street, really fun bistro. Gerard Murray is the... I think you say it. That's how you say his last name, or Maris. I might be mispronouncing it.
It's Murray, I think.
He's an awesome chef who's very well known in New Orleans. He's been cooking forever. He was, I think, before that at Ralph's on the Park. But Upper Line is open, and that's just a really great, very authentic New Orleans experience. Commander's Palace is open. Café du Monde is making beignets. You can have muffalettas. You can go to visit Susan at Bayona. Donald Link has a place called Couchon that's great. Do
you think that the New Orleans food scene will come back and it will be what it once was as a tourist destination again?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I have no doubt. It already is back. And, you know, like I said in my piece, it's a city with a ton of heart and just a lot of joy and life and... it's a beautiful place to visit, and Jazz Fest is coming up, and even if you don't go down for Jazz Fest or Mardi Gras, make a point of doing something this year to give back to New Orleans, and even if it's just going down there and eating and listening to music.
Let's throw something else out there. There is a chronic, now they have two problems in New Orleans. One is obviously there's always a housing shortage.
Mm-hmm.
But as you said, there's a shortage of staff in the restaurants.
Service shortage.
Is there work? We have so many people in the industry who listen to this show and on the web and on the radio. If someone who wanted to go down there and get a job, you know, for the summer or for the fall.
I know of a couple of organizations that are bringing chefs down there, either on a temporary basis or a permanent basis. And one of the women posted an event on my site where she's recruiting chefs to go down there, and that's happening in March, and I'm blanking on the name of it.
We'll give it to us later, and we'll put it up on the website.
I think that there are jobs. And people in New Orleans are just, they're so friendly and happy, and I really was amazed.
It's all the drinking, Andrea.
Yeah, exactly.
My kind of people. All right, well, when we come back, we're gonna talk about Andrea's top 10 list for 2006, which is published just at the end of last year, of the top 10 restaurants in New York that you should know about. And they're unusual choices. They're not the choices that you'll see in other publications, and we're going to talk more with her about that. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Kathleen showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And our guest today is Andrea Strong, queen of the food blogosphere. We were just talking about New Orleans, but I want to bring it a little closer to home. Andrea, your home base is New York City, which is hard by New Brunswick. That's what New York City is most famous for, is that it's a town close to New Brunswick.
Exactly.
But let's talk about your – I thought it was great to read at the end of the year, you published your top 10 list.
Mm-hmm.
And you, I think your top 10 list was different than, well, anybody else's.
I very much enjoyed how
like
different
Passover.
It was.
Why is this night different than every other night?
Yeah. what drove your choices? And Little Owl was your favorite restaurant. Del Posto was in a lot of people's best restaurants of the year. Budokan was in a lot of people's restaurants. But you put Little Owl and Avoce as number one and number two. Why don't you tell us about those restaurants and why they made your list as number one and number two of all 2006?
Well, the Little Owl, to me, is just one of those really special restaurants that comes along, you know, once in a very short while. It's run by a wonderful chef and a great guy in the front of the house. It's very small, and the food, pretty simple Mediterranean Italian.
So why does it beat Del Posto, Mario Batali, Joe Bastianich, and Lydia
Bastianich? It beats Del Posto for me because it's more of the kind of restaurant that I want to eat in regularly.
Mm-hmm.
And that my top 10 list is not so much like, you know, top most expensive, most incredible, you know, mind-altering, dazzling restaurants. It's more of the top 10 restaurants that, you know, you're going to really want to go to and want to go to regularly.
So rather than see per se on this list, we see restaurants like Little Owl and Avoce.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Del Posto is a beautiful, beautiful restaurant, and I applaud both Joe and Mario and Mark Ladner for opening a restaurant that really aimed higher in the Italian world than I think any other Italian restaurant in New York City in terms of just the scope of the menu, the design of the space, the size of the space. It's very elegant. It's really aiming to give a sort of Danielle Boulud experience in an Italian genre,
and I think they accomplish. I think they accomplish a lot of it too.
But I also think. I mean, this is why. I mean, the Strong Buzz is the publication that it is because, frankly, I'm not rich enough to go to Del Posto every night, and frankly, if I were, I probably wouldn't want to go there every night. It's more of a special occasion
restaurant.
Place.
Yeah, and I think that my, you know, the list is much more of a regular person's list than a Park Avenue list.
Well, a regular person of impeccable taste. Though.
Does that take us back to the blogosphere, though? Do you think that the people who are reading restaurant blogs are more regular people, or do you think it's a regular cross-section?
Surprisingly, I think that there is a wide cross-section, but I know in terms of the demographic of people who read the Strong Buzz, they're quite well off.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
And I accept donations.
yeah.
You know, my readers, there are a good chunk of them are making more money than I've ever seen in my life.
Mm.
So, but I think that the restaurants that I chose are restaurants that I feel are expressions of management and chefs that are very personal. They're restaurants that have beautiful design, great hospitality. And an articulate vision of what the food, the design, and the space are together.
Well, and also, I think that all of the restaurants you pick, you walk in off the street, and no matter who you are, you feel, you know, welcome and loved. I mean, we went to Avoce twice. I went to Avoce twice, once by myself, and once with Gail Green, you know?
Wow.
And I have to say, They spotted Gail Green, of course, who is the
they didn't spot us.
New York Magazine.
We were the guys with Gail Green.
That's right, exactly. Right. But when I went on my own, I got treated very well and very comfortably, and it wasn't like a trumpets blew when we walked into the door, but it was very warm, and that's very hard.
The experiences were similar, I can tell you.
Hey, let me ask you about another restaurant you have in here. Your number six restaurant is called The Good Fork. Talk to me about that.
I love The Good Fork, and I think it's sort of an under-the-radar gem. It did get a lot of press when it first opened because it opened in Red Hook on Van Brunt Street, where a couple of new restaurants had opened. And it's the chef is Soo-hee Kim, and she is Korean-American, and her husband is the designer, and they opened this little place where you can get steak and eggs, kimchi style, and great pot stickers, and a beautiful farm-raised pork loin, and great pastas, and it's just a really terrific neighborhood place. They live around the corner, and it's just like Little Owl. It has this real sense of just love and authenticity and passion. You know, we all walk into restaurants and, you know, you're there to eat and have a great meal and share a wonderful experience with the people who are at your table. But once in a while, it's nice to kind of look beyond your table and look at the people who put their hearts and souls into building a place that is like a home to them.
Yeah,
and
hopefully
becomes a home to you.
We totally agree with that. You know why?
Why?
Because we built two of those places.
Because one of them is after Mark's grandmother. His mother's home crying right now.
Yeah, I mean, you get that in these places. The Smoke Joint, which is a new barbecue joint in Fort Greene, these two guys have been thinking about opening a barbecue joint forever, and one of their dads goes and chops the wood upstate that they use in their smoke pit.
I mean, love it.
It's just like...
Hey, well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to put Andrea Strong's top 10 list of restaurants for 96 in New York up on our website. We're also going to link you to thestrongbuzz.com. You can subscribe, and she'll send you an email newsletter every week or two. And we want to thank you for taking the time to be on the show with us again, Andrea.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Always fun, Andrea. We'll talk to you in a few months.
Okay, sounds great.
You're listening to You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. You know, our guest was Andrea Strong. She is a writer in the print media of the highest order, and her website is in the blogosphere. We talk a lot about the blogosphere, the food blogosphere, but people are getting their information, especially about things like restaurants, which are both local and national concerns. You want to find out what neighborhood restaurants to go to, but also if you're going to one of the best restaurants in the country, you want to know what to go to. But we're one of those alternative sources of information. Now we're on the radio, of course, which is unusual. I mean, nationally, I think this is the only show exactly like this one, weirdos that we are. but also through our podcasting, people download this show all across the world and all across the country. And I think it's very interesting and important that the way that people get their information is changing, and you can participate in this. You can send us emails. What I want you all to do is go to our website and take a look at it, and if you like our stuff or if you're podcasting us, tell a friend about us, email a friend about us, and send the link and say, listen to the Restaurant Guys. They're really cool.
You know, just to go back a little bit to what we were talking to Andrea about, you know, some of these blogs are professional and done by professionals, and some of them are just kind of willy-nilly out there, somebody's diary of their food that they ate that week, like their calorie counting or something. But, you know, some of them are done by professionals but are still fairly tongue-in-cheek. There's a road here that you can go down that's kind of fun, and some of the less formal, exactly. So like New York Magazine has a blog called Grub Street, okay, which is really interesting and fun. And one of the things they do on their blog is they rate the restrooms of the great restaurants.
Yeah,
every week there's a great restaurant, a great restroom report about, you know, this one had cool doors, this one was, you know, wasn't very private, this one, you know.
Well, the other thing is in the New York Times, Frank Bruni, who's the New York Times restaurant critic, he has a blog where he writes about things that never make it into the paper, but it's a lot more casual, which is fun and funny and interesting. Anyway, I hope that you've enjoyed spending the hour with us, and I hope you do go to our restaurant website to check things out. That's restaurant guysradio.com, and you can find Andrea Strong, a lot of other cool stuff there. Hope you've enjoyed the hour. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.